From Elmhurst Public Library, this is Storytime for Grown-Ups. Stories have the power to inspire and change us. Being read to stimulates our brains, expands our imaginations, and is just plain fun. I am Margie Kohlbacher. Welcome to Season 2, Episode 3. Our first reading is a story by Dave Barry, a humorist, columnist for the Miami Herald, and author of several books. Along with the honor of winning a Pulitzer Prize, Mr. Barry is also responsible for establishing International Talk Like a Pirate Day, celebrated yearly on September 19th. Today's selection is from his book, I'll Mature When I'm Dead. Sit back, listen, and enjoy.
Colonoscopy by Dave Barry. Okay, you turn 50. You know you're supposed to get a colonoscopy, but you haven't. Number one, you've been busy. Number two, you don't have a history of cancer in your family. Number three, you haven't noticed any problems. Number four, you don't want a doctor to stick a tube 17,000 feet up your butt. Let's examine these reasons one at a time. No, wait, let's not. Because you and I both know that the only real reason is number four. This is natural. The idea of having another human, even a medical human, becoming deeply involved in what is technically known as your behindular zone gives you the creeping willies. I know this because I'm like you, except worse. I yield to nobody in the field of being a pathetic, weeny medical coward. I become faint and nauseous during even very minor medical procedures, such as making an appointment by phone. It's much worse when I come into physical contact with the medical profession. More than one doctor's office has a dent in the floor caused by my forehead striking it seconds after I got a shot. In 1997, when I turned 50, everybody told me I should get a colonoscopy. I agreed that I definitely should, but not right away. By following this policy, I reached age 55 without having had a colonoscopy. Then I did something so pathetic and embarrassing that I am frankly ashamed to tell you about it. What happened was a giant 40-foot replica of a human colon came to Miami Beach. Really? It's an educational exhibit called The Colossal Colon. And it was on a nationwide tour to promote awareness of colorectal cancer. The idea is you crawl through the colossal colon and you encounter various educational items in there, such as polyps, cancer, and hemorrhoids the size of regulation volleyballs. And you go, whoa, I better find out if I contain any of these things. And you get a colonoscopy. If you are a professional humor writer, and there is a giant colon within a 200-mile radius, you are legally obligated to go see it. So I went to Miami Beach and crawled through the colossal colon. I wrote a column about it, making tasteless colon jokes. But I also urged everyone to get a colonoscopy. When I emerged from the colossal colon, signed a pledge stating that I would get one. But I didn't get one. I was a fraud, a hypocrite, a liar. I was practically a member of Congress. 5 more years passed. I turned 60, and I still hadn't gotten a colonoscopy. Then, a couple of weeks ago, I got an email from my brother Sam, who is 10 years younger than I am, but more mature. The email was addressed to me and my middle brother, Phil. It said, Dear brothers, I went in for a routine colonoscopy and got the dreaded diagnosis, cancer. We're told it's early and that there is a good prognosis that they can get it all out. So, fingers crossed, knock on wood and all that. And of course, they told me to tell my siblings to get screened. I imagine you both have. Well, first I called Sam. He was hopeful but scared. We talked for a while, and when we hung up, I called my friend Andy Sable, a gastroenterologist, to make an appointment for a colonoscopy. A few days later in his office, Andy showed me a color diagram of the colon, a lengthy organ that appears to go all over the place, at one point passing briefly through Minneapolis. Then Andy explained the colonoscopy procedure to me in a thorough, reassuring, and patient manner. I nodded thoughtfully, but I didn't really hear anything he said because my brain was shrieking, quote, "He's going to stick a tube 17,000 feet up your butt!" I left Andy's office with some written instructions and a prescription for a product called MoviPrep, which comes in a box large enough to hold a microwave oven. I will discuss MoviPrep in detail later. For now, suffice it to say that we must never allow it to fall into the hands of America's enemies. I spent the next several days productively sitting around being nervous. Then, on the day before my colonoscopy, I began my preparation. In accordance with my instructions, I didn't eat any solid food that day. All I had was chicken broth, which is basically water, only with less flavor. Then in the evening, I took the MoviPrep. You mix 2 packets of powder together in a 1-liter plastic jug. Then you fill it with lukewarm water. For those unfamiliar with the metric system, a liter is about 32 gallons. Then you have to drink the whole jug. This takes about an hour because MoviPrep tastes, and here I am being kind, like a mixture of goat spit and urinal cleanser, with just a hint of lemon. The instructions for MoviPrep, clearly written by somebody with a great sense of humor, state that after you drink it, a loose, watery bowel movement may result. This is kind of like saying that after you jump off your roof, you may experience contact with the ground. MoviPrep is a nuclear laxative. I don't want to be too graphic here, but have you ever seen a space shuttle launch? This is pretty much the MoviPrep experience, with you as the shuttle. There are times when you wish the commode had a seatbelt. You spend several hours pretty much confined to the bathroom, spurting violently. You eliminate everything. And then, when you figure you must be totally empty, you have to drink another liter of MoviPrep. At which point, as far as I can tell, your bowels travel into the future and start eliminating food that you have not even eaten yet. After an action-packed evening, I finally got to sleep. The next morning, my wife drove me to the clinic. I was very nervous. Not only was I worried about the procedure, but I had been experiencing occasional return bouts of MoviPrep spurtage. I was thinking, what if I spurt on Andy? How do you apologize to a friend for something like that? Flowers would not be enough. At the clinic, I had to sign many forms, acknowledging that I understood and totally agreed with whatever the hell the forms said. Then they led me to a room full of other colonoscopy people, where I went inside a little curtain space and took off my clothes and put on one of those hospital garments designed by sadist perverts, the kind that when you put it on makes you feel even more naked than when you are actually naked. Then a nurse named Eddie put a little needle in a vein on my left hand. Ordinarily, I would have fainted, but Eddie was very good, and I was already lying down. Eddie also told me that some people put vodka in their MoviPrep. At first, I was ticked off that I hadn't thought of this, but then I pondered, what would happen if you got yourself too tipsy to make it to the bathroom? So you were staggering around in full fire hose mode. You would have no choice but to burn your house. When everything was ready, Eddie wheeled me into the procedure room, where Andy was waiting with a nurse and an anesthesiologist. I did not see the 17,000-foot tube, but I knew Andy had it hidden around there somewhere. I was seriously nervous at this point. Andy had me roll over to my left side, and the anesthesiologist began hooking something up to the needle in my hand. There was music playing in the room, and I realized that the song was Dancing Queen by ABBA. I remarked to Andy that of all the songs that could be playing during this particular procedure, Dancing Queen has to be the least appropriate. You want me to turn it up? Said Andy from somewhere behind me. Ha, ha, I said. And then it was time, the moment I had been dreading for more than a decade. If you are squeamish, prepare yourself, because I am going to tell you in explicit detail exactly what it was like. I have no idea. Really? I slept through it. One moment, ABBA was shrieking, Dancing Queen, feel the beat from the tambourine. And the next moment, I was back in the other room, waking up in a very mellow mood. Andy was looking down at me and asking me how I felt. I felt excellent. I felt even more excellent when Andy told me that it was all over and that my colon had passed with flying colors. I have never been prouder of an internal organ. But my point is this. In addition to being a pathetic medical weenie, I was a complete moron. For more than a decade, I avoided getting a procedure that was essentially nothing. There was no pain, and except for the Movi prep, no discomfort. I was risking my life for nothing. If my brother Sam had been as stupid as I was, if, when he turned 50, he had ignored all the medical advice and avoided getting screened, he still would have cancer. He just wouldn't have known. And by the time he did know, by the time he felt symptoms, his situation would have been much, much more serious. But because he was a grown-up, the doctors caught the cancer early, and they operated and took it out. Sam is now recovering and eating what he describes as really, really boring food. His prognosis is good, and everybody is optimistic. Fingers crossed, knock on wood, and all that. Which brings us to you, Mr. or Mrs. or Miss or Ms., over 50 and hasn't had a colonoscopy. Here's the deal. You either have colorectal cancer or you don't. If you do, a colonoscopy will enable doctors to find it and do something about it. And if you don't have cancer, believe me, it's very reassuring to know you don't. There is no sane reason for you not to have it done. I am so eager for you to do this that I'm going to induce you with an exclusive limited time offer. If you, after reading this, get a colonoscopy, let me know by sending a self-addressed stamped envelope to Dave Barry, Colonoscopy Inducement, The Miami Herald, 1 Herald Plaza, Miami, Florida, 33132. I will send you back a certificate signed by me and suitable for framing, if you don't mind framing a cheesy certificate stating that you are a grown-up who got a colonoscopy. Accompanying this certificate will be a square of limited edition, custom printed toilet paper with an image of Miss Paris Hilton on it. You may frame this also, or use it in whatever other way you deem fit. But even if you don't want this inducement, please get a colonoscopy. If I can do it, you can do it. Don't put it off. Just do it. Oh, and be sure to stress that you want the non-ABBA version.
The Moth is a radio show where ordinary people tell us their personal stories, which are often extraordinary. The Moth is a source for our second story called The Mugshot, written by Steve Osborne. Mr. Osborne was a New York police officer for 20 years and retired as a lieutenant assigned to the Detective Bureau. Sit back, listen, and enjoy.
The Mugshot by Steve Osborne. How you doing? My name's Steve Osborne. I was a New York City cop for 20 years. Now, a few years back, I was a sergeant in the Fugitive Division. Our job was to go out and hunt and catch the most wanted fugitives. This was the greatest job in the world. I loved this stuff. I used to love hunting these guys down, tracking them to wherever they would try and hide. We'd find them, catch them, jump them, handcuff them, and drag them in. It was loads of fun. I once tracked a guy down to the maternity ward while his wife was giving birth. Now, before you go, ooh, and ah, and all that, he shot 5 people. And when you start shooting that many people, I'll get you wherever I can get you, you know? All's fair. We would start work at 4:30 in the morning. We did that because we wanted to catch them in bed, sleeping. They were tired, they were groggy, and they were less likely to go for a gun or a knife or something else stupid. Now, when we would come into work, I'd grab my coffee and sit at my desk, and there'd be a stack of warrants, 5, 6, 7 of them, and the guys that we were going after that day. They'd usually be in priority order. The worst guy would be on top. Now, the guy on top this day was this kid by the name of Hector. At the age of 26, Hector was already a hardcore bad guy. He had been locked up a whole load of times for everything from smoking weed to assault, robbery, criminal possession of a weapon, and his latest collar, an attempted murder. That was the one I was concerned with. Turns out he got into a beef with the guy, pulled out a gun, and shot him. The guy didn't die, so attempted murder. Hector gets arrested and goes through the system. He goes to his arraignment, and the Bronx being the Bronx, the judge lets him out on bail with a return date of 30 days later. Well, surprise, surprise. 30 days comes and goes, and Hector's nowhere to be found. Judge gets pissed off and issues a warrant for his arrest. Now he's my problem. I gotta go find him and bring him in. Every warrant comes in a package. There's the warrant itself, signed off by the judge. There's the arrest report. And stapled on top is a mugshot. Now, you've all seen police mugshots. You know, a guy standing there with the numbers across his chest. It's the worst possible photo that anybody could ever take. I don't think Pamela Anderson topless would take a good mugshot. Well, you know, maybe her, but really, I don't think anybody else. So I'm looking at this kid's photo. He's sitting there and he's looking out at me, you know. He's got the numbers across his chest. I've been doing this for a long time. I've made hundreds and hundreds of arrests. And I can just tell by looking at this kid's face that he is going to be a pain in the ass. He has these black beady eyes, high bony cheekbones, a pointy chin, scraggly goatee, and a pockmarked face. And he has a scar under his eye, like he got cut in a fight. Believe me, it was a face that only a mother could love. Now, it's time to get to work, so I go through my checklist. I got my vest, gun, backup gun, handcuffs, flashlight, all the tools of the trade. Everything you need for hunting down bad guys. I get my team of 6 detectives together, and we head out the door. And I got that spring in my step. I love this stuff. We head over to his building. Real bad building. I've been there a couple of times before. Every time we go there, there's a problem. Either they're throwing bricks and bottles off the roof at us, or perps are fighting with us. But it was early in the morning, and everything was quiet. So I was hoping to slip in, get this guy, and get the hell out before anybody even knew we were there. We go through the front door and into the lobby, and it's a dump. There are bullet holes in the wall and graffiti everywhere. There are crack vials on the floor, empty beer bottles, urine in the corner. The place is a mess. He lives in apartment 4B. We figure out the B apartments face front. So I tell 2 of my guys, cover the front window. Now, you might think, like, who would jump out a 4th floor window and try to escape? But I'm telling you, desperate men do desperate things. And I guarantee you, if he jumps out that window and kills himself, his family's going to be on the 6 o'clock news that night, swearing to God that I threw him out the window, trying to sue the city for $50 million. So two guys covering the window might save me a little bit of aggravation. We do this every day. I take one side of the door, one of my guys takes the other side of the door, and we listen. We're listening for anything. Voices, a TV, a radio playing, kids, a dog barking, anything that might give us a clue about what we're walking into. We listen for a minute. Nothing. Everything's quiet. So it's time to hit this thing. Now, the last thing I do before we hit a warrant is I always take the mugshot out and I study it. I look at that face and I commit it to memory. Because a lot of times you go into these apartments, it's dark, and there's a lot of confusion. The family may be fighting with us. Somebody could be going for a gun or a knife. And there may be a brother, a cousin, an uncle, a nephew, somebody that looks just like him. So you want to know exactly what your bad guy looks like. I take out the photo and I'm studying it. And I see the little black beady eyes staring at me, and that pockmarked face, and that goatee, and the bony cheekbones, and that bony chin, and the scar under his eye. I take the photo and I hand it off to the next guy. He does the same thing. Everybody passes it around. Then I stick it back in my pocket. And it's time. Now, you might think that we knocked the door down, but we really don't. We knock. If I have to, I got a battering ram and sledgehammers and stuff in the car, and I'll go down and get them, and I'll knock your door down. But usually, knocking works. So I knock on the door. We're listening. Nothing. I knock a little louder. Finally, I hear a woman's voice on the other side of the door. "Who is it? What do you want?" We tell her. "Police, we got a warrant. Open the door." I hear on the other side of the door, click, 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 click. You know, like she's got 20 locks on this door. As she's doing that, we're turning on our flashlights, unholstering our guns, and getting ready. The door opens up, and there's this little Hispanic woman standing there with this pink, fluffy robe and these little pink, fluffy slippers. She's in her late 40s or early 50s. And I say, "Police, we got a warrant, we're coming in," and we push our way past her. So we go into the apartment and we do our thing. We're going from room to room, flipping up beds, pulling clothes out of the closets. The reason that we do this is because these guys will hide in the tiniest, most unbelievable places. So you gotta be thorough. So we're tearing the place apart looking for him, no sign of him. I go back out to the living room and I grab Mom and I say, "Ma, where's Hector? I gotta talk to him." She has this confused look on her face, and she says to me, "My son is dead." My first reaction is, "Bullshit. Don't lie to me. You might think I'm being a hard ass, but I'm not. Believe me when I tell you, I've had little old ladies with rosary beads and Bibles in their hands swearing to God they haven't seen their little Johnny in months. Meanwhile, the prick's behind the bedroom door with a butcher knife waiting for us to come in. It's dangerous work, and I trust nobody." So I tell her, "Look, you're not helping him. Tell me where he is. Don't make me hunt him down out in the street. That's how bad things happen. Tell me where he is, or get him to turn himself in." With that, the daughter comes out of the bedroom. She grabs her mother, and they interlock arms and hug each other. They're scared. And it's understandable. The cops are busting into their house early in the morning, tearing the place apart. So I say to the girl, "Where's your brother? I gotta talk to him." And she looks right at me and goes, "My brother's dead. He was shot and killed last week down the block." And with that, she goes over to the refrigerator and gets a business card. And she hands it to me and she says, "Here, talk to this detective. He's got the case. He knows everything." So I take the card and I hand it to one of my guys and I say, "Make a call." We make a couple of phone calls. Sure enough, everything checks out. Hector was a homicide victim about a week ago. He got shot and killed down the block. But the paperwork for that case hadn't caught up with the paperwork for my case. So I tell his mom, "Look, I'm very sorry for your loss. I'm very sorry for the way we had to bust in the way we did. But we had a warrant, and this is the way we do things." And I explained to her, "Look, I'll go down to court. I'll get the warrant vacated. I'll make sure that nobody comes and bothers you again. I'm very sorry." With that, it's time for us to go. In reality, I got 5 or 6 more Hectors we're going after that morning. But before we leave, I take the mugshot out of my pocket. I just want to make sure there's no mistaken identity, you know, that we're talking about the same kid. So I take the mugshot and I show it to her and I say, "Is this your son?" She takes one look at the photo and tears start rolling down her face and she starts sobbing, you know, that really deep, mournful sobbing that only a mother crying over her child would have in her. So I believe her. Obviously, this is her son. So I take the photo and I stick it back in my pocket and I tell her again, "Look, I'm very sorry for your loss." And we turn to leave. But as I turn to leave, she says to me, "Can I see the picture again?" I'm like, "This? This picture?" I'm confused. Didn't she get a good look at it before? Is she not sure? I'm not sure where this thing is going now. So I take the photo out and I show it to her. And she reaches out and she takes it from my hand. And she clutches it to her chest. It's like she's hugging him. And she says to me, "Can I keep this picture?" And I'm thinking, "That picture? You want to keep that picture?" So I tell her, "Look, it's a police department property. We don't normally give them out to the public." But she goes on to tell me that she has no photos of him because he was never around. His whole adult life, he was either out tearing up the streets or he was in jail. He never really came around for Mother's Day or Christmas or anything like that. And she has no photos of him. She has nothing to remember him by. When she told me this story, I felt terrible for her. You know, I'm a hardcore guy, but my heart was breaking for her a little bit. She seemed like a nice lady. I mean, this building was a dump, but the apartment, she kept it clean. She put that thick plastic on the sofa so that it wouldn't get dirty. And she wasn't cursing me out like a lot of other mothers do, blaming me because their son's got a warrant and he's got to go back to jail. She just seemed like a nice lady who lost her son to the streets, which in that neighborhood happened a lot. So I told her, "Okay, if you got nothing else to remember this kid by, go ahead, be my guest. It's yours." And she reaches out and she shakes my hand. And she thanks me. She's clutching her robe shut. And she still has those little pink fluffy slippers. She shuffles across the room and goes over to this bookcase against the wall that has all these family photos in nice silver and gold frames. You know, there was Grandpa in his World War II uniform and wedding photos and graduation pictures with the cap and gown. And very lovingly and tenderly, like only a mother would do, she took that mugshot and she placed it right in the middle of those family photos.
Thank you for listening today. Be sure to join us for our next episode of Mind Expanding Tales.
Storytime for Grownups is recorded at Elmhurst Public Library's Creative Studio Lab. Directed and edited by Jeremy Slayton. Produced and hosted by Margie Kohlbacher. Stories narrated by Duard Mosley. Works read in this podcast may be protected under copyright law. These podcasts are reserved for the education of library patrons only. Elmhurst Public Library receives no commercial gain from these recordings. No unauthorized further dissemination of these works is permitted.